From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
President Trump held a surprise press conference at the White House on Monday. In it, the president and the media covered a lot of ground. We begin by bringing you that press conference in its entirety.
Okay, well, thank you very much. You've asked to see what's going on at our meeting, so I figured let you come in, you'll look, and you'll see we have a lot of good things happening. We have tremendous progress on vaccines and therapeutics. We're getting reports. We're studying the reports very closely. I think people are going to be very pleasantly surprised with what's going on the vaccine front and the therapeutic front. And that, to us, is always the first topic. Secondarily, but very importantly, we're working and negotiating with the Democrats on trying to get a plan that helps small businesses, helps people, helps this country. And I think we've made a lot of progress on that, and the discussions are going on. Steve, do you want to say a few words as to where we are?
Yes, Mr. President. Mark and I have been working very hard over the last 2 weeks with Mitch and Kevin on really what we see as the focus is kids and jobs, the Recovery Act, CARES 4.0. We've spent an unprecedented money. The good news is a lot of the $3 trillion we still have left to put in the economy and put back to work. We're focused on starting with another $1 trillion. We think that will make a big impact. And the focus is, as I said, is really about kids and jobs and vaccines. We're going to make sure that we have a vaccine by the end of the year for emergency use. And the plan is we just updated the president and the vice president. They signed off on this. Mark and I will be meeting tomorrow with the Republicans at the lunch to give them a full briefing, and then we will also be reaching out to the Democrats to begin our discussions. But we are committed that by the end of this month, make sure that before the enhanced unemployment insurance expires, that we pass legislation so that we can protect Americans that are unemployed. Now, we've said the number one issue is we have to fix the technical fix on enhanced unemployment. We're going to make sure that we don't pay people more money to stay home than go to work. We want to make sure that people who can go to work safely can do so. We'll have tax credits that incentivize businesses to bring people back to work. We'll have tax credits for PPE, for safe work environment. And we're going to have big incentives, money to the states for education, for schools that can open safely and do education. So these are the priorities. As well as liability protection, we want to make sure that frivolous lawsuits don't prevent schools, universities, and businesses from reopening.
Okay. Mike?
Well, Mr. President, I just want to say how much we appreciate the leadership in the House and Senate. Today's conversation is a continuation of your commitment to do whatever it takes to get the American people, American businesses and communities through this very challenging time. The outbreaks across the Sun Belt are serious, but because of the support that we've had from frankly, leaders in both political parties in the Congress of the United States, we're meeting this moment with expanded testing, personal protective equipment, and as you said, Mr. President, with the development and distribution of therapeutics and a rapid development of vaccines. That will all continue, but it's important that the Congress come together and provide additional resources for families that have been impacted, businesses that have been impacted. We'll make sure our healthcare workers in our states have the resources that they need. But also, Mr. President, we're going to continue to advance policies that will make it possible for us to open up America again and open up America's schools. And I look forward, I know as you do, and working with the leaders that are gathered here and members of Congress from both political parties to deliver another important element of a recovery package that we'll keep on working until we bring our country all the way back and reach that day that we someday put this coronavirus in the past.
Okay. Mitch, please.
Yeah, tomorrow begins the process of socializing what we've been discussing with the administration over the last 2 weeks with our members. And if you're looking for a theme here. Thank liability protection for those who've been trying to deal with the pandemic. We don't need an epidemic of lawsuits on the heels of the pandemic we're already struggling with. Kids in school, jobs, and health care to be the theme of the proposal that we hope to come together and present to our Republicans. And then as the Secretary of the Treasury indicated, obviously you can't pass the bill in the Senate without the Democrats, and we'll begin to talk to them as well.
Kevin?
Yes, I mean, just to sum up what we're looking at. If you're sitting at home and you're concerned that you don't have a job, we want to make sure you're able to come back. We don't think any federal money should be spent that gives you a disincentive to work. We want to make sure we have incentives to keep going. For those small businesses, we want to make sure you can stay open. We want to make sure your kids can go back to school, but go back safely, not just for the children, but for the teachers as well. We continue to make strides to make sure we get to a vaccine, that we find a cure for this virus that we did not invite, that came from a foreign land. And I think that's the focus that we have to be a part of. Mitch talks about, and I think it's fundamental, not just for schools, but for any businesses striving, whether they can open back up or not, they should not have an attack from any lawsuits. We need to give the protection that we rebuild, restore, and renew this country to where we were before. And I know we can do it together. That's why we're working here. We'll be reaching out to the Democrats, and I hope for that moment in time, we can put politics aside, that we look at one nation, that we don't sit back inside of a rule within a Senate that a minority denies the ability to have this debate, that denies the ability to help America unite and solve this problem once and for all. We are making great strides when it comes to therapies. What this warp speed, history will write about this. When we get to the moment in time that we have this vaccine, they'll write about how fast it would, and no other country could do what we did because of the ingenuity of this nation. And that's the focus of what we're trying to do, the safety of this country, for our students, for our teachers, and for our businesses, that we're back to work again, stronger and safer and more united.
It came from China. It should have never been allowed to get out. They could have stopped it. They could have stopped it easily. They chose not to. And we'll have further reports on that. But it came from China. They could have stopped it. They didn't. They stopped it from going into China, but they didn't stop it from going to the rest of the world. It didn't stop it from going to Europe, to us. They should have stopped it. They could have stopped it. They weren't transparent at all. They were the opposite. It's not good. I spoke with the president of France this morning, and I spoke with the president of Egypt, and we had a very, very good conversation, both of us, and all of us together. I've had many conversations with leaders all over the world over the weekend and over the last couple of weeks in particular. And this is a pandemic that is flaring up all over the place. The countries thought they were in good shape, and then all of a sudden they have a big flare-up. I see that over the weekend, I guess on Friday, there was a record worldwide number of death, worldwide. Because when you watch the news, the local news, and you see it, and it's like all about the United States. They never like to talk about what's going on in the world, but you look at Mexico, Brazil, many countries in Europe, many all over, Russia. Russia's got a tremendous problem. It's what's going on is terrible. It's terrible. But this is a worldwide problem. And we're helping the world with ventilators. We're helping a lot of countries. They don't have ventilators, and we're sending thousands of ventilators to different countries. But I do want people to understand this is a worldwide problem caused by China. But it's a worldwide problem. Countries are going through hell. And it's going to, we're going to give you a lot of briefings in the next week and over the next few weeks as to, I think it's very important to do it, the vaccines and the therapeutics. I think I'm going to bring some of the great companies that are working and very successfully in the past have worked on these things, and they're going to tell you very specifically what they're doing and how they're doing. But we think we're doing very well in that regard. Those two items, I think, frankly, therapeutic, I like almost better at this point. You go in and you make people better. Now, we have had some very good luck with remdesivir. That's been successful. And others have been successful. The plasma has been successful. But we are really coming up with some very good answers, meaning they are.
all over the world. They're working, and we're working very closely all over the world on the vaccines and the therapeutics. So we're going to have some of the heads of these great companies coming in. Johnson & Johnson is doing very well in particular. They seem to be doing very well, but numerous are doing very well. It's something that I really feel certain. I guess you can never use totally certain, but pretty damn certain that they're going to have the vaccine, they're going to have therapeutics, and it's going to start taking place very shortly. And that will be a great thing for the world. That will be a great thing. But this is happening all over the world, not just the United States. And it's a tough one. It's very tough. It's very sad when you see the death. It's all death that could have been stopped by China. If they wanted to stop it, they could have stopped it. Okay, thank you very much,
right,
everybody.
Guys.
Please,
thanks,
thank
guys.
You. Thank you.
How important,
John,
Mr.
Steve,
President?
Let's go. Thank you.
How important is a payroll tax cut?
Chris, thank you.
How important is a payroll tax cut in Facebook?
I think it's very important. I think it's a very important thing. It's very good. It's been proven to be successful. It's a big saving for the people. It's a tremendous saving. And I think it's an incentive for companies to hire their workers back and to keep their workers. So payroll tax cut to me is very important. We're working on it. And I don't think there's too much dispute as to the level of importance, John. It's a very important thing. Okay? It's one of the that's one of many elements we're discussing. We're discussing probably a total of 10 different elements, but payroll tax cut's a very important one.
Are they buying? All right. Are they signing on?
Oh, absolutely. No, I think hopefully we'll get there, but we're talking about a lot of things, not just the payroll tax cut.
So they're bringing back the coronavirus briefings? Do I understand you correctly?
Well, we had very successful briefings. I was doing them, and we had a lot of people watching, record numbers watching. In the history of cable television, there's never been anything like it. And we were doing very well, and I thought it would be sort of automatic, and a lot of positive things were happening. And frankly, a lot of the country is doing well. A lot of people don't say, as you understand. But we have had this big flare-up in Florida, Texas, a couple of other places. So I think what we're going to do is I'll get involved and we'll start doing briefings, whether it's this afternoon or tomorrow, probably tomorrow, and I'll do briefings. And part of the briefing, I think, much more so than last time, because last time we were nowhere with vaccines or therapeutics. And let's say that ended 6 weeks ago, we'll start them again. And I think it's a great way to get information out to the public as to where we are with the vaccines, with the therapeutics, and generally speaking, where we are. And so I think we'll start that probably starting tomorrow. I'll do it at 5 o'clock like we were doing. We had a good slot. And a lot of people were watching, and that's a good thing. I think that Kaylee will continue hers at 11 o'clock, just like they were. And I'll be discussing the, as I call it, the China virus, the China plague. I'll be discussing it. And I'll also be discussing perhaps some other things. But, you know, we're doing very well in so many different ways. But unfortunately, this is something that's very tough, but we're going to get it solved. And I think we're going to get it solved in numerous ways, but the two best would be vaccines and therapeutics. So we'll be having that.
Mr. President, on Portland and other cities that are experiencing violence, there was a report out this morning that you're considering sending 175 federal troops to these cities to help local law enforcement. Can you fill us in on that?
It depends on what your definition of troops is. I mean, we're sending law enforcement. Portland was totally out of control. The Democrats, the liberal Democrats running the place, had no idea what they were doing. They were ripping down for 51 days, ripping down that city, destroying the city, looting it. The level of corruption and what was going on there is incredible. And then the governor comes, oh, we don't need any help. How about Chicago? I read the numbers were many people killed over the weekend. We're looking at Chicago, too. We're looking at New York. Look at what's going on. All run by Democrats, all run by very liberal Democrats, all run really by radical left. But we can't let this happen to the cities. New York was up 348%, the crime wave. So the governor has to do something about it. And if the governor's not going to do something about it, we'll do something about it. But what's happening in New York, a place I love New York, and look at what's going on over there. the woman who was shot because she said, could you please not light off firecrackers? And they turned around and shot her 8 times and she died? That's not our civilization. That's not about us. And then the police are afraid to do anything. I know New York very well. I know the police very well, New York's finest. And the fact is, they're restricted from doing anything. They can't do anything.
So what are you planning on doing?
Well, I'm going to do something that I can tell you, because we're not going to let New York and Chicago and Philadelphia and Detroit and Baltimore and all of these. Oakland is a mess. We're not going to let this happen in our country, so all run by liberal Democrats.
More federal law enforcement to some of these cities?
More federal law enforcement, that I can tell you. In Portland, they've done a fantastic job. They've been there 3 days, and they really have done a fantastic job in a very short period of time. No problem. They grab them, a lot of people in jail, they're leaders. These are anarchists, these are not protesters. People say protesters, these people are anarchists. These are people that hate our country, and we're not gonna let it go forward. And I'll tell you what, the governor and the mayor and the senators out there, they're afraid of these people. That's the reason they don't want us to help them, they're afraid. I really believe they're actually maybe even physically afraid of these people, because what they're doing is incredible. We didn't just go there. This wasn't like it started right away. We went there after 51 days. We said, we can't let that happen anymore. But these are anarchists. And the politicians out there, yes, they're weak, but they're afraid of these people. They're actually afraid of these people. And that's why they say, we don't want the federal government helping. How about Chicago? Would you say they need help after this weekend? Do you know the numbers? Did you hear the numbers? Many, many shot. Many, many killed. Many, I'm not talking about one, two, was it 18 people killed? I think more than that. And you added up over the summer. This is worse than Afghanistan, by far. This is worse than anything anyone's ever seen. All run by the same liberal Democrats. And you know what? If Biden got in, that would be true for the country. The whole country would go to hell. And we're not going to let it go to hell. Thank you very much, everybody.
After decades behind bars, all of the surviving members of Philadelphia's MOVE organization, captives of a longtime Philadelphia police vendetta, are now free. Mike Africa, a member of the group, was born in a Pennsylvania prison, and he spoke with Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford about his experience and the history of the repression of the MOVE organization.
The MOVE organization was assaulted by police. We were in our home, my mother, my father, and other members of the group. When the police came, they arrested the members in the organization, and my parents were two of the members that were arrested. And at the time, my mom was almost eight months pregnant with me. So being that our religion is natural law, the MOVE women generally have their babies at home. And my mother had a baby at home a couple of years earlier, so she was capable and aware of how, by following her instincts and understanding that that was a natural process that would conduct itself. So she had me actually in a jail cell after the confrontation.
Yes, in fact, we read in an article that your mother didn't even want to let the jail guards know that she was about to give birth.
Right, yeah, so she wanted to make sure that it was done secretly so that she didn't want the guards to try to force her to go to the hospital and do that in the hospital. She didn't want the medical, all of the doctors trying to do the medical exams or procedures that they do on babies that kind of desensitizes them and interrupt the bond between the mother and the child. So she did it in secret.
So your mother and father became members of what became called the MOVE Nine. That is the huge portion of the MOVE organization that was thrown into prison after that 1978 confrontation with the police. Now, all of those who have survived prison are out, although some never made it out of the prison.
That's right. Merle Africa died in prison on March 13th, 1998, and Phil Africa died in prison on January 10th, 2015. Yeah, so Most of them did make it out, but those two unfortunately did not.
And of those who remained outside, they were visited by another crime and atrocity just 7 years later in 1985.
Correct. When people were arrested, the members of the organization that were still on the street were protesting for the Moog prisoners' release. And the protests intensified when Moog people put a bullhorn on the outside of our house and demanded to the community and to city officials over that loudspeaker. And that intensified and escalated to the point where the city officials got involved. And even though they admitted that they believed that the Moog now were innocent, they still reacted by sending the police to our house to shut us down. Incidents escalated to the point where the police came to Moog's house and flew a helicopter over our house and dropped a bomb on our house. And the bomb sparked a fire, and the fire burned, and the police commissioner and the fire commissioner ordered their men to let the fire burn. As the Moog members tried to escape the burning house, they were shot by police and thrown back into the fire. 11 members of the organization perished. One member of the organization, Ramona Africa, was the lone adult survivor. She was arrested and put in prison for 7 years, and she was charged with arson and riot.
And that massacre of Moog, the second huge assault on the organization, was overseen by the city's black mayor, Wilson Good.
That's right. Philadelphia's first black mayor was Wilson Good. He was elected into office by black Philadelphia, who was intent on stopping Frank Rizzo. The people in the city had seen the atrocities and the racism of the white mayor, Frank Rizzo, the brutality of Frank Rizzo. And they were so desperate to get out from under that regime that rather than sit by and watch Rizzo become the mayor again for the third time, they were desperate, and so they picked Wilson Good to be their candidate, and he was elected in, and it was on his watch, but it was Rizzo's cops that did the shooting and the bombing and all of that. But it was also Wilson Good's pick of the police commissioner, who was a war veteran and a general who organized the plan with the bombing and all of that. So the two worked hand in hand. It doesn't matter the face that you put on the devil. The devil is still the devil. And in this case, Wilson Good is the face of that atrocity. And he participated in that. But the devil is the system that is the killer that's killing black people across this country. You know, like George Floyd, like Breonna Taylor, like Rayshard Brooks, like Ahmaud Arbery. It doesn't matter the color, it doesn't matter the face. The system is the system. And unless it's dismantled, if you put a black person there, a white person there, a Spanish person, we're all going to be still faced with the same oppression.
So your parents were in prison for all of your youth, but you were raised by a larger extended family. Tell us about your experience in growing up in Moog.
Well, hold on. We got to back up a little bit. I'm 41. I'm still young. my experience growing up in Moog, the members of the organization, I was around most of the members growing up. And even the ones that were in prison, I still maintained a very close connection to them. I visited them regularly throughout the times that I was available, and probably every member that was in the prison of the Moog 9 and Mumia 2, I regularly visit throughout the years. My life growing up in Moog was a very good sense of, I had a lot of learning. There was a lot of learning involved. There's a lot of getting educated about the way things really are in the world and how dangerous the system really is and the things that we need to do. There was a lot of training to learn and understand how to fight it and strategize. And we're seeing some of that strategy paying off now, because without the work that we've done and the alignments that I've made with lawyers and some politicians that were willing to support the Moog 9, would still be in prison today. So And those strategies are being extended to other prisoners that we actually hope to get out of prison too. Growing up in MOVE has been very insightful, very happy times. The happiest times of my life probably are happening now, but I did have definitely had a lot of happy, fun times growing up in MOVE throughout my life.
And what about the response of the larger Black Philadelphia community? Have you over time seen any changes or evolution in the general Black Philadelphia acceptance of and response to MOVE and its message?
For sure. So in the 80s, I would say that the organization's response from Philadelphia, period, was mixed. From Black Philadelphia, Black Philadelphia is also mixed because there's different classes, and class racism is a real thing, right? Class oppression is a real thing. The middle class or upper class Black people in the city of Philadelphia were the ones that typically did not respond to MOVE in any kind of like positive way. Usually the people that we found a lot of solidarity with were the poor Black people who we were in the community with, assisting them with their needs and, you know, helping their kids, you know, eat healthy and exercise and stay away from drugs and gangs and things like that. So, but the middle class Black people, the upper class, they were the ones that were usually against us. They would say things like, we understand what you're saying and we agree with certain things you're saying, but that's not the way to do it. You're doing it. You're too radical. You need to comb your hair. You need to dress nicer, you know, things like that. It's kind of like they were trying to push us to be more like Martin Luther King and less like Bob Marley, you know, more like Malcolm X in terms of dress and less like the guerrilla warfare brothers and sisters hanging out in the woods while they're practicing their strategies in Cuba or something. They wanted us to like comb our hair, take the dreadlocks out and wear a suit. And we were saying like, we need a radical change and trying to approach it from this sort of tame mentality. That's not going to get us where we're trying to go. And not saying that there is not a place for the people that dress up in suits and speak principle and speak truth. But for MOVE at that time, especially, we were just not those people. But the climate has changed a lot now. In the organization now, I think it's probably pretty much exactly the opposite. Back in the day, we might have gotten 20 or 25% support and 75 or 80% just not supporting us at all. Versus the way it is now, where it's probably 75 or 80 or even more than that, that's sympathetic and understand the stance that we took and why we took such a hard stand because of the environmental pollution, the animal cruelty, the people that are being locked up in prisons unjustly, the time that they're being given in prison to serve out punishments that people, white people who may have committed the same offense or even worse, got less than half the time or got no time at all. They can see the disparity. So this is kind of like vindication for us.
For most of MOVE's existence, the organization has of necessity been consumed with the struggle to get their members out of prison. Now that all the surviving members are out of prison, what's in the works for MOVE and for you personally?
For me personally, my mission is to free Mumia. That's my number one goal. Do whatever is necessary to get that brother out of prison so that he can be with his family the way that my father is with his family now. My mission is to put out as much information as possible. Currently, we're working on a couple of projects that would bring about more awareness to the people in the city of Philadelphia to learn more about his case so that, you know, they can be aware of it. This is like Nelson Mandela in South Africa right now. And so the importance of Mumia being free can be best seen by the example of the killings of George Floyd and the other brothers and sisters that's been murdered by police. We need Mumia free because that will be justice, and we're not getting justice. We need freedom. We need justice. We need equality. And Mumia represents those things. And for him to be released because he is innocent, that would be a step in the right direction for the country. The thing that needs to be understood is that police lives are not more important than civilian lives. And the sooner people understand that, the sooner they'll take those guns off those police hips. And the sooner they take those guns off those police hips, the sooner they will be beginning to even the playing field.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.